Good morning, and welcome to Integrating New Advances into the Care of Patients with Cancer. This is a multi-tumor symposium in partnership with the American Oncology Network. Dr. Neil Love will not be attending in person this year. However, I will be moderating the session today, along with our esteemed faculty. Dr. Love will be assisting and presenting video by providers throughout the American Oncology Network, who will be presenting cases throughout the session today. Welcome, AON members, to the American Oncology Annual Clinical Summit. Just a bit of housekeeping at the beginning of each session. Today's module, we'll be presenting data from actual patients within the American Oncology Network using data extracted by Meaningful Insights Biotech Analytics. This is a healthcare AI company that was initially launched with the mission to close the feedback loop between physicians, patients, and industry partners. This CME program is sponsored with MEBA data insights from the actual AON practices. The goal of MEBA is to unlock the power of data to fuel clinical decisions, improve patient and provider education, and improve patient care. Commercial support for this activity is provided by educational grants from AbbVie, AstraZeneca, Bayer, B1, Corcept, Daiichi Sankyo, Jazz, Johnson & Johnson, Lilly, Merck, and Nuvalent. Research to Practice Planning Committee members, staff, and reviewers for Research to Practice have no relevant conflicts of interest. Just as a word of advice, this educational activity does contain discussion of non-FDA-approved use of agents and regimens, and as always, please refer to the official prescribing information for each product for the approved indications. Today, we have a number of contributing general medical oncologists from the community who are part of the American Oncology Network who will be submitting video cases today in collaboration with Dr. Love. We have Dr. Sunil Babu, Dr. Zanetta Lamar, Dr. Brian Mulheron, Dr. Sean Warsh, and Dr. Jennifer Yannucci. As I mentioned, we will be reviewing some AON data regarding our patients. It's germane to the five sessions we're going to discuss today. There will be two sessions on lung cancer, followed by a session on CLL, and then GE cancers and ovarian cancers. And so, you know, throughout the AON network, a large volume, almost 4,000 lung cancer patients. Our lung cancer faculty today, Dr. Justin Gaynor is with us, and we're grateful, from Mass General Hospital in Boston. Thank you for being here, Dr. Gaynor. Dr. Corey Langer from UPenn in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Thank you for being here, Dr. Langer. And Dr. Misty Shields from Indiana University in Indianapolis, Indiana. These are our faculty disclosures. So again, circling back to the snapshot of patients throughout the American Oncology Network, data that's germane to the topics to be discussed. So 607 small cell lung cancer patients, about 464 patients with EGFR mutations, 129 or so with ALK rearrangements, and then 23 and 22 respectively with ROS1 rearrangements and HER2 mutations in the lung cancer space. We also looked at patterns of drug utilization that was pulled from the MEBA database. And if you look, you have about 387 patients with exposure to osimertinib, 61 or so with exposure to amivantamab, and lazertinib is around 29. I think there's a bit of a disconnect between the amivantamab and lazertinib, maybe due to exon 20 insertion utilization of amivantamab. With respect to the ALK rearrangement, alectinib, about 77 patients on therapy, and lorlatinib, about 36 patients. For TDXD, 25 patients throughout the network have been exposed, those with some HER2 mutation or amplification. Datopotamab, we actually had two patients. Datopotamab has a new indication for EGFR mutated lung cancer with progression, no larotrectinib patients. Had some recent data with Durva and Trimi, quite a bit of Durva use, and less so on the CTLA-4. Lurbinectedin in the small cell space, and then obviously we have the approval for the bispecific tarlatamab. That's looking at utilization patterns throughout the network. So kind of a call out to the network for having quite a bit of BiTE therapies. I think throughout the network to date, there's over 2,000 bispecific T-cell engagers been administered. So without further ado, we're going to move into the content for today. We'll let Dr. Gaynor start us off addressing targeted therapy for non-small cell lung cancer. Dr. Gaynor?
Great. Thanks so much for the introduction and for being here today. So lots to cover in targeted therapies in a short period of time. Of course, we know in lung cancer today, we have multiple distinct targets. So we're going to try to hit the highlights as we go through this talk. And then in our cases, you know, we'll take a deeper dive. We'll kick things off with EGFR mutant lung cancer. And I would say that, you know, this is an area where we've seen a ton of progress of late. And what used to be a very, I think, simple conversation with patients, right? You know, we're going to start with osimertinib, has now become a very complicated discussion, right? Because we have three first-line regimens. We have osimertinib monotherapy. We have osimertinib plus platinum pemetrexed, the FLAURA2 regimen. And we have the MARIPOSA regimen, amivantamab and lazertinib. The issues are that, you know, obviously we're balancing efficacy and toxicity. We recently saw that both FLAURA2 and MARIPOSA have now both had overall survival improvements, but these are, you know, more toxic regimens. I would say in my own practice, as we've seen overall survival benefits, I am moving towards the intensified regimens for most of my patients, although there are still some patients, maybe your more frail patients, where we're still using osimertinib monotherapy. I do know we have a case in the case discussion, so I'm going to basically move on from there, but I would say that mainly right now I'm gravitating more towards the FLAURA2 regimen, although there is still an argument to be made for MARIPOSA. You know, one of the arguments one could make about kind of choice of first-line regimens is we also know that the second line of EGFR mutant lung cancer has also evolved. So this slide is just showing you the MARIPOSA 2 study. This is taking patients who progressed on EGFR TK monotherapy and looking at the combination of amivantamab plus chemotherapy versus chemotherapy alone. And we see here that this study resulted in a significant improvement in progression-free survival. There's a trend towards benefit in overall survival, even though the p-value is under 0.05 there by the statistical design of the study that did not meet statistical significance in the interim analysis. But I do think that this is a standard of care in the second line setting for patients progressing on EGFR monotherapy. Now, we know that one of the challenges around amivantamab is the toxicity profile, particularly in the initial infusions. We see high rates of hypersensitivity reactions. This has spurred efforts to look at alternative dosing or using various regimens like dexamethasone, a prolonged period of dexamethasone. But one of the things that's most exciting is the subcutaneous AMI, because it did look like this significantly improved the toxicity profile, particularly when it comes to infusion hypersensitivity reactions. There was an intriguing signal in the same study. This is Paloma 3, which was just comparing sub-Q versus IV, where there was a trend towards better survival in the sub-Q arm, but you know, the mechanism by which that may be driven is still unclear, and that wasn't a primary endpoint for the study. We're still waiting on the FDA approval of the subcutaneous form, but I think once that comes through, I think it will be certainly adopted. Rounding things out for EGFR mutant lung cancer in the classical mutations is Dato-DX. This was recently approved earlier this year, response rate of around 40%. This approval is based on a compilation of data from two different studies. showing, again, response rate around 40%. This does have toxicity in the form of stomatitis, alopecia. Typically, right now, I'm thinking about this as a third-line agent. Moving on to EGFR exon 20, new standard of care based on the Papillon study is the combination of chemo plus amivantamab. You can see a nice improvement in progression-free survival and a waterfall plot showing increased responses. The response rate here was around 60%. Now, for EGFR exon 20, we've also now wanted to think about what's the role of TKIs. We did recently see an FDA approval in the form of sunvorsertinib. You can see this agent, which was largely studied in China, had a response rate of approximately 45%. Here we're seeing a PFS in the 7 to 8 month range. So this is approved. The challenge right now is that my patients haven't been able to access this commercially yet. So it's approved, but not prescribable as of yet. Hopefully that changes soon. In terms of tox profile, you know, these are some of the classical EGFR effects of diarrhea, rash, paronychia. There are several other EGFR TKIs coming down the pike. This is zipalertinib, showed a response rate in the 40% range. And again, some of those classical EGFR TKI effects of rash, diarrhea. There are many ongoing studies now of these agents trying to displace chemotherapy, but notably you see in all these designs, there's no amivantamab in these designs. For the sake of time, I'm going to move on to ALK. So we know we have multiple different ALK inhibitors. Most of our discussion is going to be on the second, third, and fourth generation inhibitors. We know as we go from up in generation, we go up in potency against ALK. We increase coverage of ALK resistance mutations. The highlight here is we saw in Berlin a couple weeks ago, updated data from the ALEX study showing overall survival in ALK-positive lung cancer. And what was striking is if you look at 84 months, right, you know, you're seeing about 50% of patients still alive at 84 months. So this is marked, how long patients with ALK-positive lung cancer are surviving. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, that's overall survival. When we look at progression-free survival with the CROWN data with lorlatinib, we see that at 5 years, 60% are still progression-free. Which is marked. We don't have OS data from the CROWN study, but based upon this PFS benefit, my practice has been to use first-line lorlatinib, given the profound benefit. There are other agents coming down the pike for ALK. This is neladalkib. This is a fourth-generation ALK inhibitor, and you can see here promising response rates around 40% in patients previously treated with ALK TKIs, and now a randomized study is ongoing. ROS1 fusions, I know I'm going quick. There's a lot to digest here. ROS1 fusions, we have multiple now approved agents. We have entrectinib, response rate is about 70%. Repotrectinib, even higher response rate, acknowledging cross-trial comparisons. But I think what's most marked here is the PFS of 35 months. And now the new kid on the block, taletrectinib, which was recently approved, we see here now a PFS of 45 months. So, you know, we're constantly pushing PFS improvements when it comes to ROS1. And there's another ROS1 inhibitor that's currently in development, zidesamtinib. This agent has shown promising response rates of about 45%. In patients previously treated with the TKI, and what's not shown on this slide is very high response rates in the treatment-naive setting. So hopefully we will have another option very, very soon. This is a slide that one of our fellows put together comparing these agents, and you can see that, you know, taletrectinib, repotrectinib, you know, performing better than some of our earlier generation inhibitors. This does not include some of the newer ROS1 inhibitors. And then rounding things out, HER2. When we talk about HER2, we really need to differentiate HER2 mutations versus HER2 expression. We'll kick things off with HER2 mutations. Most of these mutations are in exon 20. We see our first approval was trastuzumab deruxtecan, producing response rates of around 50%, PFS in the 9 to 10 month range. What followed thereafter is a tumor agnostic approval for HER2 3+ staining. This is looking at the lung specific data showing a response rate of around 50% and a median duration of response of 7 months. So this is something where I am now routinely asking my pathologist to perform HER2 IHC staining as well as MET staining now. What is new in the HER2 space when we're talking about HER2 mutations are some of the HER2 TKIs. So in Berlin several weeks ago, we saw some of the first-line data from zongertinib. This is a novel HER2 TKI. And I thought these data were extremely impressive. We saw a response rate of 77% in treatment-naive patients. This agent is now FDA approved, and you know, looking at these data, my impression is that this should be shifting into the first line setting based on these data. That's not the only HER2 TKI. We also have sevabertinib. These data were also presented at ESMO a few weeks ago. We also see here in the treatment naive setting a response rate of 70%. So this looks, you know, very, very encouraging. In patients previously treated, the response rates do drop. I was struck that if you look at patients previously treated with HER2 ADCs, the response rate in that setting was more in the 38-40% range. So to me, that's telling me that maybe we should be thinking about TKIs before ADCs. But clearly, we don't have as much data in that space. So I recognize I've gone very, very quickly, but happy to take questions as we look at our cases. But this is really just to say that, you know, targeted therapies have continued to evolve at a very, very rapid pace, including in what was previously a pretty simple treatment algorithm such as EGFR mutant lung cancer. So with that, maybe I'll hand things back.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Ginney. I just want to level set. So I was in Chapel Hill with Mark Sosinski, and I remember being at ASCO in the late 90s, you know, when he stood up on stage and said, you know, four cycles of platinum and taxane, and nothing has ever been shown to provide any benefit over and above that. We treated lung cancer as two buckets, small cell and non-small cell. And, you know, your first slide showed how that pie's been divided up. And so thanks for doing such a great job of plowing through all the actionable mutations and targeted therapies that we have. And I know our other faculty are going to dive into that as well. I wanted to present a few cases now to provide some granularity, and then we'll get into some questions going forward. So first case is a 65-year-old female with an ALK mutant metastatic adenocarcinoma of the lung who also had an elevated PD-L1 expression with a TPS of 70%, presented by Dr. Zanetta Lamar. From Naples, Florida.
Good morning, everyone. This is Neil Love from Research to Practice. Again, this year, happy to partner with Fred Divers and Aon members to once again put on a multi-tumor CME event, not only for the attendees in Dallas, but an international live audience and others who will watch and listen to this event for months to come on our online platform. Over the last few weeks, I met with Aon members Dr. Sunil Babu, Zanetta Lamar, Brian Mulhern, Sean Warsh, and Jennifer Iannucci, who are about to present to the faculty compelling cases from their practices and issues for you to discuss, beginning with lung cancer. And Dr. Lamar has been treating a 65-year-old woman with metastatic ALK-positive adenocarcinoma for more than 5 years.
Back in October 2020, I started her on alectinib. And she actually did really well on that. She had a complete response. She was able to continue working. And so she continued on alectinib until April of 2023, when she had some signs of progression on a CT scan. She was started on lorlatinib, and she's actually been on that for 2 years. But I would be curious if she were to progress again, what would the faculty consider as third line treatment for her?
How did she tolerate the alectinib and how did she tolerate the lorlatinib?
With the alectinib, she was actually concerned because she had weight gain and just felt fatigued. She was actually also was a caregiver for her mom. And so it wasn't until she switched to lorlatinib that she said, you know what, I actually feel better on the lorlatinib.
Any questions you want to have them discuss about this case?
So now I started this particular patient in October 2020. I mean, it was the height of COVID, and we were grateful to have an oral medication. I am curious, if she were diagnosed now, how would she be treated? The other thing is that she had a PD-L1 TPS score of 70%. At what point after you've cycled through your ALK therapies, do you think about immunotherapy?
Okay, so a lot packed in there, a lot of questions. But Dr. Gaynor, and I know you mentioned earlier you might lead with lorlatinib now, but in 2020 maybe it was a different story. What is your preferred first-line treatment for lung cancer patients with advanced disease and an ALK mutation now?
Yeah, you're right. It has evolved. In 2020, I would have said alectinib. But in light of the updated CROWN data, where we still haven't reached a median PFS yet, right? You know, we're at 5 years, and the PFS still the median still hasn't been reached. It's at 60%. And if you even look at the, excuse me, the slope of that PFS curve, between years 3 and 5, it's only gone down, 8%. So, could we be thinking about a median of 7-8 years? I think it's certainly possible. So for me, right now, for most of my first-line patients, I'm using lorlatinib.
Perfect. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Langer.
Pretty much agree. I think lorlatinib has displaced alectinib based on the PFS data, which are astounding and really unprecedented. Remember, this is metastatic non-small cell. We also see major CNS penetrance, 4 and 5 year CNS progression-free survival, 85-90%. Again, unbelievable, considering the propensity of this cancer to go to the brain. The problem is the toxicity. And I'm amazed that Dr. Lamar said that this patient had less toxicity on lorlatinib. That has not been my experience. We see elevations in cholesterol and triglyceride, which is relatively minor, fair amount of edema, and then neurologic toxicity, mood changes, in some cases psychiatric issues, neuropathy, ataxia. It is, by and large, with one exception, all of my patients are not on full dose. They're on reduced dose.
Yeah, that's a great call out. I mean, what a wonderful world oncology would be if we had that Kaplan-Meier survival curve for every disease state, right? There'd be a lot of heroes in this room today, so, and our patients would benefit. Second question, with respect to your usual treatment for a patient with progressive disease, who, for example, in 2020 maybe started first-line alectinib and then subsequently switched to lorlatinib, where are we in the third-line setting here? Who wants to take this one?
I'm happy to kick things off. Our team has been very interested in understanding the biology of how resistance develops to these agents. Some of the things that we've learned is that when patients are treated with alectinib, about half of the time they'll develop an ALK resistance mutation, and pretty much uniformly, those ALK resistance mutations are able to be overcome by lorlatinib. The challenge is that you start building a scaffold of kind of ALK resistance mutations. And so when patients progress in this sequence, they can develop these compound ALK resistance alterations. So my practice has been I'll at least send ctDNA. I'll think about a biopsy. If they have a compound ALK resistance mutation, that's where I'm thinking about the next generation, like the fourth generation ALK inhibitors. If they don't, I think the standard of care would be platinum doublet chemotherapy, platinum pemetrexed. The last thing I'll say is that patients who don't have on-target resistance with ALK, we see MET amplification in a very high proportion of these patients. So about 20% of patients will have MET amplification. And you know, we now know, you know, there are a variety of different off-label approaches one could think about there.
Great, thank you, Dr. Shields. What do you think about the role for the new tyrosine kinase inhibitors in this space?
Thank you, Dr. Divers. So, you know, I think with this field, it's so exciting. We're seeing so many transformative changes, and I agree. When we saw the data at ASCO with Crown just a year ago, what a tremendous amount of progress that has been made. You know, I think for my first line treatment, my preference for ALK fusion positive metastatic non-small cell lung cancer is actually really more of a shared patient informed decision making process. I do talk about alectinib as well as lorlatinib, and I do share the consensus here with the toxicities of these agents is meaningful, and you really have to take into the comorbidities into effect, not only metabolic syndrome like diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, but also any history of potentially psychiatric illnesses that may be worse or mitigated by the agent you choose. And so I think that it, you know, really there's equipoise for me to choosing alectinib or lorlatinib here. And so therefore, you know, really those agents in the second line, I think you really have to focus on the patterns of progression. Is this oligo progression? Can we potentially do targeted therapy with SRS or radiation to a local site of progression? If there's multifocal progression, I would probably, again, grab chemotherapy, looking for trials, looking at molecular profiling for resistance if there's an agent, there's a site I can biopsy. And then again, talking to the patient about what the role of these other agents might be. I think NVL-655 is very exciting. I'm excited to see that data as it progresses. But I do think the details matter here.
Yeah, I think that's a great call out. You know, we sort of glazed over that to the beginning. Like, you don't know about all these wonderful things unless you test. And so making sure that every person with locally advanced and advanced non-small cell lung cancer is truly tested, I think is critical. Dr. Langer?
We test both liquid and tissue. We do that routinely, virtually all patients. In fact, we have a deal with one of the liquid companies to get those the venipunctures done even before the first patient visit. The hardest thing in the world, the hardest thing that we all face as clinicians is a newly diagnosed metastatic non-small cell patient whose PD-L1 is not back. We don't have their molecular back. All we can say is you have bad cancer, it's metastatic, and I haven't a clue yet how to treat you. So expediting that workup is absolutely essential and probably one of our biggest challenges.
Yeah, I think it's a good call out, particularly with the Medicare 14-day rule on the tissue. You know, it's a good solution. Gaynor?
I just wanted to answer the question in the video about the role of PD-1 inhibitors very quickly there. The short answer, there is no role for PD-1 inhibitors in ALK-positive lung cancer, I think, ever.
So, due to ILD toxicities? Or
no, just lack of efficacy.
Lack of efficacy.
Like the response rate is close to zero.
Okay.
The high PD-L1 is a fake out.
Got it. Thank you.
A red herring.
Thanks for the clarity. Okay, next case. We're going to go ahead and present Dr. Iannucci.
Dr. Iannucci is providing care for the next patient, an 84-year-old Korean woman who in the pre-Adore days of 2019 had a left upper lobe EGFR exon 19 deletion adenocarcinoma of the lung removed surgically and pathologically determined to be T1CN0M0. 2 years later, she started osimertinib for recurrent metastatic disease, and now 4 years later has disease progression and is receiving amivantamab, carboplatin, and pemetrexed.
After the first cycle, I had to dose reduce her. After cycle two, she suffered a DVT and PE. She is now on therapeutic anticoagulation. She received cycle three today, and the plan is to restage her after three cycles. But she is continuing on treatment, continuing on therapeutic anticoagulation, and having a tough time, but we'll see how it goes. So questions on her would be, for a patient like this with progression on EGFR-targeted therapies, are there any other options in your eyes for these patients besides the amivantamab plus chemotherapy? Would anybody use the Dato-DXd? And is there anything that you can do to prepare patients for that particular regimen, especially with the mucositis? And in the future, do you think that Dato-DXd is going to be first line.
Any questions with the faculty about first-line treatment of EGFR mutant metastatic disease?
If someone has excellent performance score, low or high volume disease, do they definitely need to get this chemo EGFR combination? Amivantanab and lazertinib is definitely a more toxic combination than using single agent EGFR mutation treatment. Can we modify, give a couple of rounds and then pull the amivantanab out?
Okay, so we knew we were going to get into this, right? So questions for the faculty today. So for those EGFR mutated advanced non-small cell lung cancer patients, right, it was a lot about quality of life, tolerability, response rates are great. What are your preferred option in the frontline setting, Dr. Shields, with respect to the three options that are sitting out there?
Thank you so much for that wonderful question. This is of utmost importance. I think this is what we're all facing in clinic, and we see this, and it's hard to effectively and efficiently counsel patients through this because it does evolve over time, and it may be some of the combination strategies like amivantamab and lazertinib. We know that first 4 months, the risk of DVT-PE is high, and so there should be prophylactic anticoagulation in that onboarding period. We also know risk of infusion-related reactions, right? We saw with the Skipper data to help reduce that with the introduction of pre-meds of dexamethasone. We also saw with the Cocoon data the supportive care to help mitigate some of the dermatologic toxicities that is related to this combination. So I think there's a lot of support out there. It's a lot for patients to unpack in a visit. And also you have to think about also the time toxicity. There's a lot of infusions. There's a lot of time that's spent over an infusion for patients in this kind of step-in dosing while they're being placed on this therapy. You know, that's where kind of going for a single pill, one pill once a day is a lot easier for patients to understand and I think integrate into normal life. It feels more like a vitamin you take every day than it does to have hours spent in an infusion center multiple weeks in a row. And so I think with this, the selection really for me depends on risk factors, patients' comorbidities, and performance status, and their support at home. Do they have the means and the support? Are there ways that we can help get them there to be able to get on the therapy that's most important for them? So I think that, you know, while I'm thinking about both the biology of the cancer, the brain mets, the liver mets, also the genomics, PVD3, namely. I think there's a lot to unpack here, and there's not really a right answer for one patient without weighing in all these other variables.
Okay, just to put you guys on the spot, Dr. Langer, Dr. Gaynor, all things being equal, good PS patient, you want to do some combination, not just OC. Do you have a preference?
Flora 2.
Okay. Because I know that's what the guys in the room want to know, right? I mean, that was a big issue. So, okay, moving on to the next question. How do you select second-line treatment for EGFR mutant metastatic non-small cell? How does that vary based on your decision in the frontline setting? Dr. Langer.
So I think the other key issue here, and we didn't really hear the data, is that you re-biopsy. You get another liquid biopsy. There are mechanisms of resistance. The mechanisms of resistance for EGFR are far more heterogeneous than resistance for many of the other mutations and fusions. So incumbent upon us to really figure out what's driving the growth, what's driving the actual resistance. We've seen bypass pathways. We've seen MET amplification, particularly in this era of OC. The amivantamab may have a particularly good role but in those with MET amplification, either alone or in combination with chemo. I have to hand it to Dr. Iannucci for giving this triplet in an 84-year-old. It's a tough regimen in a 65-year-old.
You're healthy in Florida, though.
Apparently. I guess they drink from the fountain of youth. But as she has pointed out, she's had a dose reduce. It's been labor-intensive both for the patient and for her staff. But that is at least one standard. I've generally reserved datopotamab deruxtecan for third or fourth line not for immediate second line. I don't think we have no phase 3 data yet. That's still pending. On the other hand, we do have phase 3 data for the chemo and amivantamab combination. Prior to that approval, I would generally, when I was sure that patients were truly TKI refractory, that there was no further role for a new TKI or the addition of another TKI, I would give them chemo, pemcarbo alone or combined with bevacizumab. And I have to state for virtually all patients with actionable genomic alterations, combination chemotherapy is sort of the final common pathway because eventually you run out of room with the oral agents.
Well, I think this is a blessing. You know, there was a time when progression after TKI for EGFR mutated lung cancer was really a data desert. You know, you had really limited options, so it's a blessing. Dr. Gaynor, what are your thoughts about the bispecific nature of amivantamab in this role with respect to MET? Does that play into decisions here in the second line setting and beyond?
Well, my approach is very similar to Dr. Langer's, which is, you know, typically you're thinking about a Mariposa 2 regimen in the second line setting and reserving Dato-DX in the third line. Of course, though, that's going to be influenced by what you do in the first line. That's really hard to do, right? If you're doing Flora 2, someone's already on pemetrexed and then they progress, that's where we get into these tricky scenarios. But for a situation like the case here where someone was on OC monotherapy, I think that's where it's much more straightforward to go to a Mariposa 2 regimen. And we have to remember that as far as chemotherapies go, pemetrexed versus Dato-DX, right? Alopecia, you know, stomatitis, you know, pemetrexed is, in my view, a much, you know, better tolerated chemotherapy than Dato-DX. But of course, you're pairing it with amivantamab, and that's where you're really seeing the toxicity.
Yeah, I think two great lead-ins to the next question is one, you know, I think we're all aligned in saying, you know, sub-Q amivantamab data looks really good. If you look at that tornado plot, right, from a side effect profile, it's really quite impressive. From a tolerability, what are your thoughts about, you know, I think a number of people in this room have had Dato-DXd on trial in lung cancer settings, you know, the stomatitis that I think Dr. Iannucci called out and using the oral dex. Are you guys doing that routinely?
Yes.
There was a shortage on the oral dex at one point, right? I mean, it was a bit of an issue. What do you think on the ocular toxicity side? As oncologists in the community, we find more and more needs for our physician friends and other specialties to help manage these toxicities. How do you guys mitigate the ocular toxicities here, Dr. Shields?
So with full transparency, I actually have not had a patient on Dato-DXd, so I couldn't speak to this particular issue, but I'd love to hear the panel's
thoughts. I engage an ophthalmologist to co-follow. And myelosuppression, stomatitis, skin rash, we're pretty familiar in how to handle those toxicities as oncologists. Eye toxicities are really out of our, they're off our lane. They're really not on our radar. So I try to get optometrists or ophthalmologists to co-manage steroid drops there to help. You have to avoid putting contacts in, so revert to glasses. They're basic mechanical things to be done. Not a big toxicity. ILD seems to be lower with this drug compared to my experience with trastuzumab deruxtecan, but it's still a major issue, and it comes on like gangbusters when it hits.
What about the fatigue or asthenia here? And do you routinely, Dr. Gaynor, use the methylprednisolone eye drops here?
So I like Dr. Langer, I partner with ophthalmologists. Like, there are some simple things like the contact lenses, reminding which you sometimes may not even think about, right? Lubrication drops, and I generally try to have them see ophthalmology first. But I recognize it is sometimes hard getting them in, right? It's hard reading their notes. It's like, what? But you know, it's where, like, actually picking up the phone or writing emails with my ophthalmology colleagues to guide. Because these are not things that oncologists are used to prescribing, too.
Right. So, what do you guys think in the exon 20 mutant space? So the insertion mutation, de novo patient walks in the door with advanced disease. What's your preference there, Dr. Langer?
Pemcarbo, amivantamab. I think that's the standard. We've seen a doubling in PFS The patient's fit enough, that would be my preference. And usually they are, at least initially. What to do second line becomes problematic since you've...
You drop the carbo-PEM after the first four?
I drop the carbo after the first four. I try to continue the PEM. I may have a lower threshold for dropping it for toxicity. It's intriguing that the AMI tended to continue on even after the PEM was suspended in the phase 3 trial. But to me, that's the standard. Now, whether the new oral agents are going to displace that remains to be seen, and I think stay tuned. We'll get a lot more data in the next year or two.
Okay, yeah. Great. Next, we're going to move on with some additional cases from Dr. Mulhern.
The next case is a flashback from the 2024 AON meeting where Dr. Mulhern presented a patient that I'd like to reconsider 1 year later because of a series of stunning developments, including at the very recent ESMO meeting in Berlin. And as Dr. Gaynor just reviewed in his presentation, we saw stunning data on the use of two new HER2 TKIs, zongertinib, a covalent irreversible agent, shades of BTK inhibitors, which was just approved for patients with HER2 TKD mutant lung cancer, and sevabertinib, a non-covalent reversible TKI, currently under FDA priority review for the encouraging data that's been observed. Let's start out again with Dr. Mulhern's case from a year ago.
This is a 69-year-old lady, a never smoker, who presented with dyspnea, weight loss, cough, 3.5 centimeter right upper lobe nodule, liver mets, adrenal metastasis, bone mets, and two small cerebellar metastases. Adenocarcinoma, PD-L1 positive at 20%. She had a HER2 mutation and started first-line carboplatin pemetrexed pembrolizumab, did receive stereotactic radiosurgery to her cerebellar metastases, and is now on T-DXd and is fortunately responding well.
Any questions for the faculty?
Right now, we have T-DXd approved in the second line. What about using it in the front line? And let's say she was HER2 positive by expression, by IHC. What do you think about using T-DXd in those cases?
So the never smoking part of this case is relevant to the new understanding of the phenotype of HER2 TKD mutant lung cancer. And the follow-up from Dr. Mulhern in this case is that the patient was doing well and responding to T-DXd when she had an episode of unrelated perforated diverticulitis requiring an emergent partial colectomy, and she ended up transitioning to hospice because treatment was held and she had disease progression. Of great interest is that looking back, this patient in fact did have a HER2 TKD mutation, which leads me to ask the faculty, is HER2 TKD mutant lung cancer the new EGFR or ALK? And if so, how are we going to sequence chemotherapy, IOs, T-DXd, and these new TKIs?
There's a lot to unpack there. But I will level set. So I saw a super healthy Olympic pickleball player who grew through, had an EGFR mutation, TKD, grew through... EDXD, but did respond to zongertinib.
To HER2.
Mm-hmm. Or HER2, excuse me. Sorry. But did respond to zongertinib. So I think, and I think we've delivered, I think on the slides, 4 or 5 doses or patients have been treated with this, given its recent approval. So what are you guys' thoughts about TDXD and zongertinib in this space? As Dr. Love called out, is this the next OC for this subgroup of HER2 mutant patients? Dr. Shields?
Yeah, so again, this is a really rapidly evolving area and really trying to break open the HER2 mutant non-small cell lung cancer space. I think that, one important thing on that patient case is I would have probably held the immunotherapy and not given immunotherapy in this realm of mutations with HER2, similar to EGFR and ALK fusions. We do not see much efficacy with immunotherapy in this space with HER2 mutant disease. So in that scenario, this is where testing at diagnosis with an effective panel to have a broad-based NGS testing to know what you're facing and what is driving this disease will help you guide all areas of sequence for therapy, first line and beyond. just to reduce the risk of ILD in the second line with T-DXd post-IO, especially if it's not efficacious. I think the data with zongertinib is very exciting. Again, an oral TKI with this space. And I think with the secondary and kind of gatekeeper mutations that may occur, I personally would like to see this earlier followed by T-DXd. That would be my preference, but I know we're not quite there yet.
I agree. I think Destiny 4 is the ongoing phase 3 that's comparing trastuzumab deruxtecan or T-DXd to KEYNOTE-189. Intriguingly, historically I hadn't really used immunotherapy in HER2-mutated patients. That will certainly determine whether trastuzumab deruxtecan can move to frontline. Right now its approval is strictly second line and beyond. The general sense is that the new oral agents are, despite their typical TKI toxicities, are better tolerated. The specter of ILD doesn't seem to exist, and that, of course, can be devastating. So they, too, are either about to or undergoing phase 3 testing up front. IOs, again, I reserve for third or fourth line, typically. And if they go through sequence trastuzumab deruxtecan, then, or vice versa, oral agent, then trastuzumab deruxtecan, third line treatment will probably be a chemo combination, again, PEMCARBO with or without BEV.
Dr. Gaynor, what do you think with respect to zongertinib and savolitinib regarding toxicities? Diarrhea is obviously a common issue with these. What are your thoughts in this HER2 mutant TKD patient population? And I'll give you, do you like the TKI frontline?
I do. I think in lung cancer, what we've historically seen, right, is if you're producing response rates 60-70%, right, usually that's good enough to go into the first line setting. And I think that the zongertinib data, passes that bar in my view. I do think, these agents, the efficacy data looks very good for both of them. We need to see longer follow-up, in terms of the PFS, et cetera. They're still somewhat immature. They do differ in terms of side effect profile. I was quite struck by the SEVA data that the rate of diarrhea for that was 80-90%. So, what does that look in the lived life of a patient? So the rates were lower with zongertinib. It was more in the 40-50% range. So I think that's one distinction.
Great. Thanks for differentiating that. All right, we're going to move on to our next case with Dr. Warsh.
The next case, presented by Dr. Warsh, is a 73-year-old man with locally advanced non-resectable squamous cell carcinoma of the lung, who was treated with chemoradiation therapy followed by durvalumab and subsequently had locally recurrent disease and was found to have a MET exon 14 skipping mutation.
Based off of the findings on this NGS testing, we started him on tepotinib 450 milligrams a day. He started this about 5 or 6 months ago, and over the course of treatment, he developed some significant rash as well as hypertension requiring a dose reduction. So we sort of did the standard where we held the dose, wait for the symptoms to resolve, and then resumed at a lower dose. And he's doing a little bit better on the lower dose. So this lends a couple questions as far as stage 3 lung cancer. Certainly when you're dealing with stage 4, you look for actionable mutations in frontline, as it'll certainly change management. In stage 3 lung, not always send NGS right away because, like we said, if we do chemoradiation 1 year of immunotherapy, is that going to really change our management? Although I know there's some updates as far as doing targeted therapy as opposed to immunotherapy. So it's the question is, what mutations are you looking for specifically and how would the NGS testing change your management right off the bat? And then the other question as far as NGS testing is, this patient was not a heavy smoker, but also had squamous cell. So are we more likely to send for NGS testing before the year of immunotherapy in patients if it's squamous or adeno, or you just treat, non-small cell lung cancers the same? And then another thought I had, this patient had MET mutation, a pretty new mutation, started him on tepotinib. And there's a new medication. I'm looking through the guidelines as far as common side effects.
All right. So great question. You know, we have data, I guess, in the, you know, with OC and ALK inhibitors in the adjuvant setting. What are your thoughts for a stage three treated, Dr. Gaynor, with chemoradiation, you know, for consolidation therapy in that space?
Yeah. So if we go by the kind of level one evidence, you know, there we have EGFR would be the place, right, based on the LAURA data. However, in my own practice, you know, if I had an ALK patient there, recognizing that we don't have prospective data, we have retrospective data, but you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, PD-1 inhibitors don't really work in ALK-positive lung cancer. It's an incredibly low TMB tumor type where I'll think about off-label ALK-TKI as consolidation. I would say, you know, I know the question's asking, what other alterations? So I generally lump, so that's EGFR and ALK. In that category, I put ROS1, RET, those are NTRK, you know, those are low TMB tumors, never smokers. Generally not giving TKI to those people, like we really don't have any data there. Next, I put, you know, as you go along, I think HER2, I agree with what was mentioned earlier, but I would with a caveat, which is that there are two different types of HER2 mutations, right? There's the exon 20 kinase domain mutations, but there are some extracellular mutations, right, that have actually much higher TMBs, and they do respond to PD-1, so the type of HER2 mutation matters. MET, I would put a little bit more, you know, patients with MET can be smokers, they have a higher TMB, so I would think about durvalumab in a MET patient, and then for KRAS, I would absolutely use durvalumab. So that's how I think about it.
Sure. Dr. Langer?
Include BRAF in that group as well.
Totally.
So BRAF, MET, and KRAS, those entities where durvalumab, I think, has a clear-cut role. And frankly, in stage 4, or recurrent disease, I would have equipoise comparing a chemo-IO combo to the oral agents. I don't think we're not seeing ALK level or OC level results with drugs like tepotinib or capmatinib, at least for MET14, and they are toxic. So I know there's been retrospective studies, including by folks in your shop, looking at various outcomes, response, PFS, and OS for those who are either treated up front with chemo-IO or treated with the appropriate oral agent. I think the way that this patient's been managed is fine, and it underscores the need, I believe, to essentially get NGS on everybody. 5 years ago, I wouldn't have said that, but we are seeing mutations pop up in folks with squamous cell or NSCLC, NOS, you know, not otherwise specified. You solve a lot of problems by getting as much tissue as possible for all the various assays we need to do.
Dr. Shields, you concur?
I do, I want to emphasize the point of a lot of these rare malignancies of the lung. We actually just had a recent brief report in JTO showing the role of NGS testing in other rare tumors like adenosquamous and carcinosarcoma. If you don't test, you don't know, and you can't treat. So I do concur on the NGS testing. I think there was a recent study, Zhuling Li led this effort looking at MET exon 14 skipping mutations and in concordance with their PD-L1 score of greater than 50%, pursuing IO first. If less than 50%, then pursuing the MET exon 14 TKI like capmatinib, tepotinib first, and then pursuing IO. So I think that would be relevant to this question.
Two quick call-outs. One, great on the TKD extracellular, and you can look it up on your NGS report. I had to Google it or ChatGPT it. Secondly, the fluid retention with those MET-X on TKIs is real. Next case, Dr. Iannucci.
The next case is from Dr. Iannucci, a 73-year-old woman who in 2019 presented with cognitive changes and headaches, prompting brain MRI that demonstrated two right-side-enhancing lesions and a primary tumor in the lung. She underwent surgical resection of the brain, followed by stereotactic radiosurgery for this adenocarcinoma. The PD-1 level was 61%, and the patient was found to have a ROS1 fusion, and then received entrectinib, which resulted in tumor response. In 2023, there was disease progression, which was treated with pembrolizumab, carboplatin, and pemetrexed. The patient responded and continues on this treatment currently.
How you would sequence her therapy? Would you do anything differently in retrospect? she's going to progress, undoubtedly. What would you do next upon progression? A question for the faculty would be, where does ROS1 come into her treatment plan as far as sequencing, as far as perhaps using it up front prior to IO therapy, or even adding the chemotherapy to the IO therapy up front?
Okay. In general, how would you sequence the various available target agents in the ROS1 mutant lung cancer space? And again, addressing the role of immunotherapy. Dr. Gaynor?
Yeah, so, looking at the various ROS1 inhibitors you have, right? Crizotinib, I would say, not really used right now, right? This patient got entrectinib. We know that with those agents that a subset of them will develop on-target ROS1 resistance mutation, in particular this solvent front mutation, this G2032R, which is analogous to G1202R in ALK. And that is an alteration for which we have next-generation targeted therapies. There's some data with repotrectinib with it, overcoming it in terms of available agents. And the Zyta data looks very, very good. It was designed to overcome a lot of these resistance alterations. So that would be, if I didn't have access to a trial right now, I'd be thinking about repo. But I'd be looking, Zyta for a trial for this patient. And then to your last point, like ALK, remember ALK and ROS1 are like 80% homologous to one another, and they behave very, very similarly. So I generally don't use PD-1 pathway inhibitors in ROS1.
Dr. Langer, quick question. So if you had a ROS1 fusion advanced patient present, what would your first line choice be?
So I think effectively repo and taltrectinib have displaced crizotinib and entrectinib. It's really amazing. I mean, this is 1-3% of all our non-small cell patients. We have 5 drugs for this. Remember, lorlatinib also has activity here, and I think that speaks to the homology that exists between ALK and ROS1. So had this patient presented now, I would probably offer taltrectinib.
What about the off-target TRAC-BC? I mean, right, because those are real with repo. I mean, I had a cardiothoracic surgeon I treated, and he couldn't speak, talk, etc., and so we made a switch, and he was dramatic improvement.
Switch to taltrectinib.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So the neurologic issues are real, and these are tricky agents. And one of my colleagues is convinced that virtually all our TKIs were overdosing patients. That, the MTD that's been established in these trials may be a little bit higher, or maybe a lot higher, than what patients really can tolerate and what they really need. We've never really done proper randomized trials looking at various doses. So fortunately, we have an embarrassment of riches, so we can't switch.
Dr. Shields, any comments in the ROS1 space on you?
No, I would say I concur. Historically, I was always speaking about entrectinib to patients with ROS1 fusion lung cancer, but I think now with the displacement with repotrectinib and taletrectinib, I think that is meaningful. I do think that the neurologic toxicities are very real, and they're a little bit hard for patients to describe or to grasp. And so I think asking multiple questions and also asking family members if they've noticed differences in the patient's personality or activity, I think is also very important for us as providers.
I think it's important too, right? This is a subset of diseases that have a high incidence of intracranial metastases. Those symptoms can overlap, and so trying to differentiate those two, I think, from a management in the community is really important. Dr. Langer, any last thoughts before we move on to your talk?
No, I think I have to hand it to you folks in the audience. I don't know how you can deal with multiple different cancers. I have enough difficulty just wrapping my head around lung cancer and all the various permutations, combinations. Our prior treatment was very monolithic, as you pointed out earlier. It was carbopaclitaxel. And now we have about 15, 17, 18 different, really different cancers and different therapies for each one.
Yeah, really, really a blessing for our patients and for the providers to be an oncologist in this day and age. With that, we're going to move on to our next discussion in the lung cancer space. I would just remind those in the audience, there's a pre-meeting survey. You have iPads that are linked in, and you can submit questions as needed. So please fill out the pre- and post-surveys for us. Dr. Langer, again, is going to discuss non-targeted therapy We spent a great deal of time talking about actionable mutations. Now we're going to address non-targeted therapy in the non-small cell and also recent developments in the small cell space. Dr. Langer?
A lot of ground in 10 minutes. So here's the title and the various topics we'll go through. This is my current paradigm. I could change at any moment, probably next week or next month. For those who are 50% or higher PD-L1 expression, arguably single-agent Pembro, for that matter, cemiplimab would be the standard. But certainly in certain circumstances, patients are ill. Fulminant disease, you can argue for a KEYNOTE-189 or 407 approach. Histology-appropriate chemo plus Pembro. And that study is ongoing. The INSIGNA trial is directly comparing these two regimens in KEYNOTE-189 to Pembro in non-squamous metastatic non-small cell. 1 to 50% generally chemo Pembro ahead of Pembro alone, although there is an approval. For less than 1%, no single agent. You need to give combination chemo with an immunotherapy, again, Pembro or cemiplimab. For those with high TMB or squamous histology, many of us have used combinatorial immunotherapy, so Ipi-Nivo, or in my institution, we've actually been using Poseidon to some extent. TKI refractory, as I mentioned earlier, PEM-carbo, with or without bevacizumab. On occasion, we've used the Empower 150 regimen, which is PAC-carbo-bev and atezo. Some have called that the kitchen sink. I imagine my colleagues have very similar paradigms, at least for non-study patients. There are high-risk individuals. STK11 KEAP1 mutation has been associated with poorer outcomes. So if you look at both the Dana-Farber, Memorial Sloan Kettering, patients with STK11 and KEAP1 seem to have lower overall survival compared to the wild-type population when treated with PD-1 inhibitors. If you look at ICI monotherapy and PFS, STK11 mutant population median of 2 months versus 4.8 for the wild-type group, KEAP1 mutation 1.8 versus 4.6 for the better group. For chemo combinations with ICI inhibitors, again, better outcomes in the wild-type population. Yet there are data, in vivo murine experiments that have shown an enhanced anti-tumor effect from adding CTLA-4 inhibitors to KEAP1 deficient tumors, as shown here. And we've seen that clinically in the Poseidon trial. So if we look at a population that's STK11 mutant, PFS 1 year, 35% for the Poseidon approach. Remember, this is durva, tremelimumab, and histology-appropriate chemo versus chemo alone. Virtually no one progression-free at a year. Hazard ratio of 0.47, again, small numbers. Keep one very similar, 30% 1 year PFS versus zero, and OS commensurate improvements for the four-drug approach compared to just chemotherapy alone. And this is now being tested prospectively in phase three, basically comparing Poseidon to KEYNOTE-189 and non-squamous metastatic non-small cell with either STK11 KEAP1 or KRAS mutations. Again, good performance status patients. Got to have both tumor tissue available to do all this. This is called the Triton trial. So one of the few trials that is actually comparing some of the standard approved regimens. Last 2 years, we've seen data for bispecific monoclonals. Ivonescimab is one of the perfect examples. This targets both PD-1 and VEGF. This is the Harmony 2 trial design, directly comparing Pembro to ivonescimab in PD-L1 positive patients, so 1% or higher, with the primary endpoint being PFS by blinded independent radiographic review and the key secondary endpoint overall survival. You can see the stratifications. This is a positive trial. It was presented at World Lung during the plenary session in 2024, a virtual doubling in median PFS from 5.8 to 11.14 months, a fairly impressive hazard ratio, 0.5 with lots of zeros in that p-value. And the benefits were seen regardless of PD-L1 status or histology. In fact, the hazard ratios for each of these cluster around 0.5, and that includes the 1 to 49% group, although typically we would not give single-agent Pembro alone in that population. Harmony 6 was presented just 2 weeks ago at ESMO, a squamous-specific trial, metastatic disease, comparing again, a China-specific trial looking at their version of pembrotizalizumab with carbo-pac, so regimen sort of similar to 407, versus ivonescimab combined with chemo, and again, a PFS benefit, 6.3 months for the control arm versus about 11 months for the combination, the hazard ratio of 0.8 and lots of zeros in that p-value. The benefits were seen pretty much across the board, regardless of age, gender, stage, PD-L1 status, the presence or absence of liver or brain metastases, and again, regardless of PD-L1 expression, although notably in that 50% or higher group, where the a checkpoint inhibitor alone or in combination would probably do better, you see perhaps a less pronounced effect. Toxicities are shown here. The immune-mediated toxicities are very similar. You do see an increase in VEGF-related AEs, including proteinuria and bleeding, but mostly grade 1 or 2, by and large. And as for grade 5 events, there's really no difference. Remember, this is a squamous population where the equivalent agent, bevacizumab, is prohibited. So for whatever reason, we seem to be getting away with this combination. Switching to small cell in our last 4 minutes, Adriatic, again, this was presented a year ago at ASCO 2024 by Dave Spiegel to a standing ovation. Limited stage small cell, patients getting standard chemo rads, going on to Durva for 2 years versus placebo. You see OS benefit, hazard ratio of 0.73, p-value 0.01, about a 11% absolute improvement. You are starting to see a plateau in the curve beyond 3 years. Again, benefits seen across the board regardless of subgroup. Here's the PFS curve. So again, 46% versus 34%, similar hazard ratio with benefits seen pretty much in every group. Expected toxicity, nothing untoward. AEs leading to treatment discontinuation, about 16%. You do see only two treatment emergent AEs leading to fatality, and a bit more toxicity, but tolerable by and large. So that's really the new standard for limited stage small cell. And the benefits, once more, were seen regardless of whether patients got carbo or cis, whether they got PCI or not. An intriguing sidebar here for the PCI yes group, 3-year survival, 62%. For the PCI no group, 50%. Maybe a surrogate for the role of PCI, which will be investigated in the MAVERICK trial. And then for carbo, again, 65% survival at 3 years. For those who received cisplat up front, it looks like it was about 52%. Extensive stage, which is the vast majority of patients with small cell. We now have long-term survival data for the standard regimens, IMpower 133, with the Tezo combined with the topoisomerase platinum. 5-year survival rate now, double digits, 12%. Typically in the pre-IO era, it was 2 or 3% at best. Similar data for Caspian, 3-year data, 18% versus 6%. It looks like it'll probably level out at about 10 to 12% for the benefit of discussion. Pembro performed similarly. It's not FDA approved here, but there was statistical malfeasance when this phase 3 was done, but very similar data at 3 years, 15.5% versus 6%. Probably doesn't matter which IO is used. This year at ASCO, the IMforte trial was presented. This is combination of Tezo and Lurbi maintenance versus Atezo alone in the IMpower 133 setting. Two important caveats. Patients with brain mets were not allowed on study, which is in contrast to our typical small cell population, and there was no crossover allowed. You see a significant improvement in both PFS and OS, about a 12% absolute improvement at a year in OS with a hazard ratio of 0.73. As you'd imagine, a bit more toxicity, treatment discontinuation, 6% versus 3%. All cause grade 3 or 4, 38% versus 22%. This is the first study, to my knowledge, in the maintenance setting in extensive stage small cell to show both a PFS and OS benefit. And this would have been the stellar news of the meeting, but that was actually, I want to mention that we just saw the FDA approval for Lurbi in this setting, although many of us were actually using it before the approval, but that came a month ago, and you have to prepare these patients beforehand, because if you spring the Lurbi on them after they've gotten through the chemo, it generally doesn't fly. Tarlatamab really stole all the thunder at ASCO. So to remind everyone, this is a bispecific T-cell engager, binds to T-cells through CD3, essentially summons the T-cells to the small cell through binding to DLL3, the delta protein, attacking and hopefully eradicating the cancer cell. The original phase 2 data shown here, both 10 and 100 milligrams, at least initially weekly, very similar response rates in the nth line setting, second, third, fourth, 32 to 40%. 12-month survival in this setting, again, much better than we've seen historically at about 57%. Median survival in the initial reports of over nearly a year and a half. The big issue here is cytokine release syndrome and ICANS. About half the patients experience this. Virtually all are grade 1 or 2. And by the third dose, this side effect essentially goes away. So that set the stage for the Delphi 304 trial, a direct comparison of tarlatamab to chemo du jour, topotecan for the most part, Lurbi or amrubicin in Japan, in the second-line recurrent or metastatic setting, a 5.5-month improvement in median survival, 53% alive compared to 37% in the control group. Again, unprecedented hazard ratio here of 0.6. We see a similar improvement in PFS at a year, 20% versus about 4% free from progression. The benefits for survival are seen across the board. Objective response is higher, 35% versus 20%, and these responses are far more durable. Toxicity really, except for the CSR, quite manageable. In fact, if you look at grade 3 or higher toxicities overall, 27% versus 62%. The grade 3 or 4 toxicity rates were higher in the chemo arm, and there were no grade 5 events for either ICANS or CSR. We're now moving forward. This is now being exported to the maintenance setting and to the frontline setting. This is a presentation looking at combination tarlatamab with either atezo or durva as part of maintenance with the 9-month PFS, roughly about 40% overall, maybe a tad better for durva for what it's worth, although these are very small numbers, and survival at 9 to 12 months of nearly 90%. We're about to witness a major, major breakthrough in small cell. Finally, the ADCs. We're looking at them in non-small cell. We're certainly evaluating them in small cell. So TROP2, CES6 as targets, DL3 and B7H3. These, the latter two are highly expressed in small cell. Give a bit of information in ifinatamab deruxtecan. Again, this is a humanized anti-B7H3 monoclonal. Linked to a warhead, a topo 1 inhibitor, payload, deruxtecan, you're all familiar with, by a cleavable tetrapeptide-based linker. Response rates at the higher dose, 12 mg per kg every 3 weeks, about 55%. This was a dose-seeking study of 8 mg or 12 mg per kg. You see pretty similar PFS, maybe a tad higher for the higher dose at the median of about 5.4 months. More dose discontinuation, more toxicity at the higher dose, but generally manageable. Remember, this is really chemo 2.0. You do see ILD, the most part grade 1 or 2, one grade 5 event in the lower dose. And this is an expanded series now, well over 100 patients with response rates approaching 50%. Yet another agent, which doesn't have a name yet, so I call this license plate therapy. Higher dose, again, response rate of about 40%, very similar PFS, 5.7 months of median survival, 11.5 months. So small cell is the new frontier, the new breakthrough at this point. Limited stage, the consolidation with Durva for up to 2 years is the standard of care.
with 10 to 12% absolute improvement in long-term survival. Of note, the median duration in that study was only about 9 or 10 months, so calls into question whether we need 2 years. The addition of checkpoint inhibitors to standard etoposide platinum, again, the standard of care, and we're finally seeing 5-year survival rates of 10% or higher. Lurbi combined with the Tezo in the maintenance setting is the standard of care for now, but that might be displaced. Higher PFS and OS, certainly more toxicity. Tarlatamab is the new standard of care in the second-line setting, dramatically displacing either Lurbi or Topo. Advantages across the board, including patient-reported outcomes. And the role of ADCs remains to be determined. I'm still a little skeptical. I think so far they're a single. Tarlatamab is a double or a triple.
Awesome. Thanks, Dr. Langer. Many thanks to the faculty. We asked them to put an immense amount of data in a 10 to 12-minute slot here so that we have time for discussion, you know, and to address questions at the end. So with that, we're going to ask Dr. Shields from IU to go through neoadjuvant and perioperative approaches. I know there are a lot of questions. It's also a very busy space from the standpoint of management. Dr. Shields?
Thank you so much. So I'll get through this fairly quickly. What an exciting time for patients who are diagnosed with earlier stages, so potentially resectable non-small cell lung cancer. And this is so meaningful because so many patients are getting and should be getting who are high-risk lung cancer screening. Takes 3 minutes. There's no IV. It's low-dose CT scan. And so patients who are eligible are more likely to have early stage and therefore are more likely to be cured of lung cancer and really transforming this disease as we know it. And so these are meaningful because these are patients who are potentially resectable. So going through this data here first with CheckMate 816, this was a phase 3 study looking at patients with stage 1B to 3A, again, 4 centimeters or greater primary tumor with TNM 7th addition here. Patients were randomized 1-to-1 to Nivo chemo versus chemo for 3 cycles prior to the restaging and consideration for surgery. Patients were allowed to get adjuvant chemo or RT and were followed up for a minimum of almost 60 months on study. And what we saw here was the event-free survival here really almost tripling in the Nivo chemo versus chemo only, really, with a 49% versus 34% at 60 months here with that addition of Nivo to the neoadjuvant setting. We saw the final overall survival data of CheckMate 816 with a hazard ratio of 0.72, with the Nivo chemo arm being 65% alive at 5 years compared to 55%. We know that patients who have a pathologic complete response or path CR do better. And what you can see here is the two top curves with chemo or Nivo chemo. With those path CRs, patients are alive and doing well at 5 years. Those patients who do not achieve a path CR, unfortunately, I think it's a little bit more of a tricky course for us. Those patients have inferior survival with or without the addition of Nivo chemo, therefore kind of putting a plug for potential perioperative approaches here. So maybe there is a role for patients after surgery to getting additional immunotherapy. And so that landscape really has been conquered by several amazing studies. CheckMate 77T, Aegean, and 671 here with Nivo, Durva, and Pembrolizumab as the immunotherapy agents of choice as shown here. And so seeing these, I know this is quite a busy slide, but a very busy space, I think, if you will, and a very exciting space from the regulatory side with some of these agents going up for review. So again, these are patients, so 77T were patients with stage 3A non-small cell lung cancer per the 8th edition of AJCC, no prior treatment, getting Nivo and chemo for 4 cycles versus chemo alone, restaging, then going to surgery, followed by the adjuvant role of Nivo for 13 cycles versus placebo, and followed up. With the GN, again, we saw a little bit of a controversy with the contribution of parts here, calling into question a little bit of the study design, but again, still seeing that signal, which we'll get into, with patients who had resectable stage 2A to 3B, AGC 8th edition here, treatment naive rate randomized 1-to-1 Durva with chemotherapy 4 cycles versus placebo and chemotherapy for 4 cycles prior to surgery, with, again, the role of adjuvant durvalumab versus placebo for 12 cycles. And finally, we saw the KEYNOTE 671. This is the agent the study with pembrolizumab as the agent, with the role of chemotherapy, either cisgem or cispemetrexed, compared to cisgem or cispemetrexed alone for 4 cycles surgery, followed by pembrolizumab or placebo for 13 cycles postoperatively. And so really in this space, we see a lot of event-free and disease-free survival benefit with these agents. Again, here, the Nivo with an improvement in the event-free survival at 30 months, 61% versus 43% with a hazard ratio of 0.61 with significance here over placebo alone. And then we see the trend towards, but not yet, an overall survival benefit with this agent here at 30 months. Again, lots of censoring in the curves, hazard ratio of 0.85 at this interim analysis. With the GM, we see the event-free survival benefit, again, 16.1 versus 47.9 at 36 months with Durva compared to placebo in the perioperative space, again, with a hazard ratio of 0.69. Again, not seeing that we really have a OS benefit yet, again, at 36 months with data maturity of only 35%, with a lot of censoring in both of those curves. With the KEYNOTE-671 with pembrolizumab here at 5 years, 49% versus 26% event-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.58. And the overall survival here of 64.6% versus 53% with pembro versus placebo in this perioperative space with a hazard ratio of 0.74, so having the significant improvement in survival here with pembrolizumab. With KEYNOTE-091 and EMPOWER-010, now shifting gears, looking at the adjuvant space only. So these are patients who had confirmed stage 1, so greater than 4 centimeters. This is AGCC7, 2 or 3A non-small cell lung cancer, had undergone complete surgical resection with an R0 margins, had PD-L1 central testing, and then received 1 to 4 cycles of cis pemetrexed, gemcitabine, docetaxel, or vinorelbine. Can't say I've given that one recently. Randomized 1-to-1 to best supportive care versus atezolizumab for up to 1 year or 16 cycles with survival follow-up in the EMPOWER-010 setting. And then in the KEYNOTE-091 setting, patients were given pembrolizumab every 3 weeks compared to placebo alone after adjuvant chemotherapy and randomization. And what we see here with KEYNOTE-091 here with disease-free survival, a little complicated here with the intention to treat PD-L1 greater than 50% or any PD-L1, again, without the significant hazard ratios here really hovering around 0.8 for all arms. Again, EMPOWER-010 with disease-free survival seen in PD-L1 positive, so 1% or greater in stage 2 and 3A, as shown here with disease-free, median disease-free survival of 68 versus 37 months here with a hazard ratio of 0.70.
Thank you so much, Dr. Shields. We're going to move right into our next cases. I know everybody's brimming with lots of questions. I have some from the audience want to get to. Real quick, before we jump into the video, one quick question. You guys mentioned this earlier in the MET space. Great question. MET skipping mutation, MET amplification, and high PD-L1. How do you sequence? So if you have MET skipping mutation and amplification, you guys commented about the presence or absence of immunotherapy in that space and its role. And the patient's PD-L1 70%. Super quick thought.
I mean, I'm still doing TKI in that setting, just based on kind of the response rate of the TKIs there are 60, 70%. So I tend to use TKI there.
Okay.
I do too, although I'd have equipoise comparing TKI to checkpoint inhibitor. One of the few circumstances, frankly, if they were lower, say 20%, histology-appropriate chemo plus a checkpoint inhibitor, again, compared to the TKI. I've not been as impressed with outcomes in MET as I have with the other AGA, the genomic alteration.
The one tricky thing that can happen, though, is with the PD-1 inhibitor on board, when you try capmatinib or tepotinib afterwards, you can run into significant tox. So that tips me a little over to the TKI camp.
I agree.
great.
Yeah, I think it's complicated. Before I saw that real world data from Xu Ding Li and the investigators, I think I would have gone with the MET TKI. But I think in a PD-L1 very high population, I would lean towards that. I think unfortunately these MET TKIs, you do run into tox regardless as well. So I'm not sure how much that would change my decision there.
Thank you so much. All right, Dr. Mulhern's got a follow-up case for us.
The next case is presented by Dr. Mulhern, a 64-year-old man with a 25-pack year smoking history who presented with worsening shortness of breath, cough, and found to have a 3.6 centimeter right upper lobe nodule and a 1.6 centimeter right hilar node, an adenocarcinoma, which was treated with neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy.
He's had cis-pem and pembro for 4 cycles, and he had a pathologic CR. So a couple of things here. Should he get adjuvant pembrolizumab, as was done in KEYNOTE-671? Does the PD-L1 affect your decision? What is the best option for these patients? If you're going to start with pembrolizumab, should we really commit, as the trial did, to finishing off adjuvant therapy? What if he had stage 3 disease, so a larger tumor size? I think many of us are especially more likely to start with at least neoadjuvant, but does the bulkier tumor push you more toward doing a true perioperative approach? And then what about MRD? Does that help you make a decision? Let's say he had a PCR, but he's MRD positive. Are you more likely to go on adjuvant pembro?
So one other thing about this case that's kind of interesting is that the PD-L1 level was 0, and he had a path CR. Of course, he also got chemo, but I'm just kind of curious, have you ever seen a dramatic response in metastatic disease to IOs with a PD-L1 level 0?
I think one of my favorite patients, this was several years ago now, before we had first line checkpoint inhibitors approved. And her PD-L1 was 0, and we gave her nivolumab, and she had a complete response. And now it's like 9 years later, and she's still alive.
So yeah, the PD-L1 story deepens, right? Oncology only gets more complex, especially in the ivonescimab data that you presented. So some questions for the faculty. What are your thoughts? I'll let you start off, Dr. Shields. This is your bag. How do you generally approach the neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy for a localized on small cell lung cancer?
Yeah.
I guess real quick, let's go down the row. Everybody get neoadjuvant now for TT and T2 and greater?
For stage 2 and 3A, big T2, sure.
Yeah, greater than 4 centimeters.
Yeah, I mean, I would say most of the time, I think the place I have equipoise and our surgeons have equipoise is 4 centimeter tumor, node negative, PD-L1 0. That's a situation where, do you do upfront surgery, neoadjuvant? I think you have some equipoise there. Outside of that, though, it's all, neoadjuvant perioperative for me.
Yeah, I think, while we have seen data with PD-L1 low or even PD-L1 negative having some benefit, I still do hesitate and reserve neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy for PD-L1 high or bulky tumors where I'm concerned. I think that in the patients who have 4 centimeter tumors, I've had a patient just like this week, and PD-L1 negative, is the juice worth the squeeze for that patient to undergo, or should they just go to surgery and we can review the moleculars and the disease after it's been surgically resected?
Yeah, I think the slide you showed was quite striking in those who achieve the pathologic CR and those who don't. I mean, it really is a differentiator in the space. The tickle question, I guess, would be, as you brought up with the STK11 and KEAP1 folks, do you bring a second CTLA-4 inhibitor in the neoadjuvant space if we ever get data there? You're shaking your head. Absolutely.
No, I mean, Mark Awad, in 77T, there was another arm of that study, right? That Mark Awad presented at ESMO 2024, I think, and looking at Nevo Ipi, and that clearly looked worse. Like you see, the curves weren't that impressive because of, I think, the upfront toxicity.
The Ipi Nevo without chemo, though.
Right.
Wrinkle. Mm-hmm. Off study, I've not done that yet. I just worry that that's a bridge too far, particularly in this setting. And, the toxicities can be quite severe and quite tricky. And remember, these are folks who are, we hope, destined for cure.
Yeah, and I think also all STK11 mutations are not the same. So I think that's also important. Generally, you see this co-alterations of KRAS, KEAP1, STK11, PD-L1 low. But sometimes you'll see an STK11 with high PD-L1 a no keep one. Usually STK11 drives down the PD-L1, that's the biology of it. But not all STK11 mutations are the same. Beautiful work out of Dana-Farber looking at this.
Quick, we'll go down the row with these last two questions in the last 30 or 40 seconds. Okay, does everyone receive postoperative immunotherapy? That's a pretty broad general question. You want to start, Dr. Langer?
I would say, so if they received neoadjuvant therapy and had a path CR, I think it's a conversation, and I wouldn't feel strongly, you know, about giving that back. If someone did not receive neoadjuvant therapy, and we're talking about just adjuvant immunotherapy there, to me, I think, you know, I go by overall survival, and the overall survival, the only study where we've seen overall survival is IMpower010 in the 50% and above group. So I reserve adjuvant immunotherapy largely to the PD-L1 50% and above patients in the adjuvant setting, which is why I tend to, you know, prioritize neoadjuvant therapy. We know from kind of the melanoma field that PD-1 works better when the tumor's in situ, so I'm generally prioritizing it.
Okay, well, quick question, ctDNA, are you guys using it, Dr. Shields?
Not currently in this space. You know, I know that there are some monitoring pathways to with commercial assays. I am currently not. I'd love to hear the panel's thoughts.
Not currently, but one very important paper presented at ESMO in the BR31 trial, which was the negative effort for DERVA in this setting. It was a Canadian implemented trial, adjuvant DERVA post-surgery plus or minus chemo. No PFS, no OS benefit, but they had tumor-informed circulating tumor DNA, and those who were positive, about 10% of the overall population, clearly had a benefit, and it was a striking benefit. The hazard ratios were under 0.5. So I think there's going to be a role we need to really...
maybe the benefit fine-tune. Washes out in the absence of selection. Okay, next case, Dr. Sunil.
The next case is presented by Dr. Babu, who's particularly interested in Dr. Langer's feedback.
60 years of age, smoker, ECOG-01 with stage 4 lung cancer, no brain mets, but painful lesions, some liver lesions, and the PD-1 comes back 50% squamous cell histology. Technically, in a scenario like that, we could get away with single agent Pembro. Is just giving single agent Pembro adequate for a patient who can handle much more? So is there a PD-1 level Dr. Langer will be comfortable with where we can use that single agent? And how does he approach, you know, some of this resistant biomarkers like STK11, KIT mutation in a scenario where there is more than 50% PD-1? How do you incorporate all this information? Is giving single agent pembrolizumab adequate?
Any other lung cancer questions for Dr. Langer and his colleagues?
In a patient who progresses on a single agent immunotherapy, you know, for PD-1 greater than 50, or a chemo immunotherapy where we used only one agent, is there any utility in adding a CTLA-4 when the patient starts progressing? Is that a valid approach in someone who does not, whether they have mutation or not, in STK11 or KIT mutation, or not, is there any utility or is it just a waste of time?
You guys didn't know you were getting called out up here. So, okay, Dr. Langer, you want to respond?
I'm on the hot seat for each of these questions. So how do I approach first line for patient PD-L1 negative? I have to confess, for squamous PD-L1 negative, I've leaned toward combinatorial immuno. Remember in the original 227 trial and the 9LA as well, the five-year survival rates were about 18 to 20% for what it's worth with the Pembro histology chemo combination, about 10%. So these are cross-trial comparisons. We're really in a data-free zone, but I have leaned there. Otherwise, it's been generally histology-appropriate chemo plus Pembro. I would have had equipoise, though the trial never happened, comparing 9LA, for that matter, Poseidon to histology, appropriate chemo plus Pembro in that population. As for STK11 and KEAP1 mutations, again, I think this is a study question. The Triton trial that I highlighted is actually addressing this. I have to confess, again, if they do have that, they're being treated off trial. I have on occasion, maybe two occasions, used the Poseidon regimen. At least we have some data there, and they look reasonable. This is a group, by and large, not destined to do well, even with immunotherapy. And adding, he actually had two questions. One was adding a CTLA-4 inhibitor if a single-agent PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor wasn't working. There's no data for that that I'm aware of going on, although anecdotally, again, when I've seen inadequate response to, this again, there's no FDA approval here, for 189, a couple of us have gone to Poseidon, and we've seen responses. It's purely anecdotal. That's not what I would do typically off-study. Adding chemo later is being added, addressed in the Insignia trial. So there's actually three arms for metastatic non-squamous, non-small cell, KEYNOTE-189 versus single-agent pembro, followed by either chemo alone or chemo with pembro continued beyond progression. So that question will be addressed in a clinical trial.
Great call out. Okay. In our last minutes, we're going to go with a case from Dr. Warsh and get back to the small cell space.
The next case is presented by Dr. Warsh, a 59-year-old man with a 45-pack-year history of smoking who underwent a workup for dyspnea and weakness and was found to have widely metastatic small cell carcinoma of the lung. After four cycles of carboplatin, etoposide, and durvalumab, the PET demonstrated complete metabolic response. The patient has begun maintenance durvalumab.
We think we get people through the chemotherapy. We give them a little chemo-free interval, although there's been some pretty encouraging data recently about lurbinectinib in maintenance combined with atezolizumab. The data is positive, but my question is this a meaningful overall survival benefit where it would really change your management? And I know a lot of times there's a positive study, but is it enough to really move the needle? And then I guess the question is, would that change your management up front, adding in atezolizumab, knowing that you might do lurbinectinib as maintenance going forward, if that's really changed your practice patterns? And then sort of thinking down the road a little bit for this guy who, you know, like I said, you know, overall, you know, he's young, he's healthy, he's in good shape. My thought would be if he needs second line or when he needs second line therapy, thinking about tarlatamab. So in these sometimes, well, oftentimes when small cells recur, they recur very quickly. So do you sort of get the ball rolling for BiTE therapy early on when they're in remission, or do you wait until they're a little closer to needing it? Because for this guy, I would hate to wait, and then all of a sudden we're behind the eight ball trying to get him into this therapy.
Anything you'd like to hear them discuss about tarlatamab?
I'm just curious what your experience with this is. Have you seen, you know, meaningful benefit?
And what's the current status of the patient?
He's gotten a couple doses of the durvalumab and is, yeah, doing very well. And I'd say this patient, he would want to be aggressive. And I think, he's had, you know, family members with cancer and he sort of knows what it's in store. And I think the fact that he tolerated the carboplatin etoposide so well, I think he'd want to, you know, keep his foot on the pedal and keep pushing with the as aggressive treatment as possible.
Lots to unpack there. Okay. So given the data with LARBI, Dr. Shields, you got somebody you just finished in their own consolidation. Darva, do you add the LARBI?
Yeah, so I think this is a really important question, right? So we've seen the data from both IMforte as well as Delphi 304 with the second line tarlatamab, and recently with Delphi 303 with the maintenance role of tarlatamab here with either IO agent durvalumab or atezolizumab. And so I do use maintenance lurbinectedin. I've given this actually already to a few patients. I think it's very important to note, number one, patients should not have brain metastases. Lurbi is a semi-synthetic derivative of trabectedin and is a large compound and does not have blood-brain barrier penetration. That is why there is the exclusion on the study. This is really meaningful because this is a sanctuary site for small cell lung cancer, and while that chemotherapy may have been holding something at bay that was not radiographically evident, I do emphasize caution with switching to this regimen because we know immunotherapy alone may not have, immunotherapy may not cross the blood-brain barrier, and we saw the data at ESMO just presented a few weeks ago. that showed the area of progression on Inforte was namely in the Lurbi arm in the brain. And so that's important. Now, if you look at the flip data of the atezolizumab maintenance, we see that the highest area of progression was in the liver, which is also very meaningful for patients, can actually prohibit additional lines of therapy and cause real harm to patients. And so for that reason, we see that extension of the progression-free survival benefit with the addition of Lurbi, I do use that. Again, knowing that you should have supportive care with G-CSF in that regimen, either on body or next day after the addition of therapy. So I do think it's meaningful. I think that tarlatamab is right on the heels of this regimen with the Delphi 303 showing a median overall survival presented at ESMO with that extension arm of 25 months for first-line therapy, 25 months. But it's important to note only 24% of patients responded to tarlatamab once they were switched to the maintenance arm. So I think it's also important that not all patients, not a home run for all patients in this therapy, and so therefore biomarkers. We know the DLL3 on the initial tarlatamab studies was actually one cell was considered positive, one cell. So we don't have a biomarker yet for these agents. I think more is to come. I am using it. You should counsel patients and counsel them early when you're getting started so they're not surprised when they switch to maintenance therapy.
Really, really great summation, Dr. Shields. Dr. Gaynor, what about tarlatamab and your thoughts? Any contraindications, utilization of this agent, given the impressive data that Dr. Langer showed?
No, I mean, I think right now it's you know, standard of care second line. I completely agree. My experience has been with it. I haven't been impressed by the CNS activity of tarlatamab. I see a lot of CNS failures on patients receiving tarlatamab. So you know, if someone's got a lot of brain metastases, I don't necessarily count on it to
control. You continue the tarlatamab and SRS and ICE?
Yeah, I will, exactly. And at least in terms of real-world data, it doesn't look like that increases rates of, like, ICANS. So right now, it's second line, but like others, you know, I'm hoping we move it early. In Berlin a couple weeks ago, we saw first-line use, which the 12-month OS data was very impressive. I think it was like 80% at 12-month OS. But also, you know, there's a lot of toxicity if you're giving platinum, topoisomerase, PD-1, and Tarla, right? So I don't think that's going to be a one-size-fits-all approach for people.
Okay, in our last few moments, quick, Dr. Langer, you want to comment about the IDXD data? I thought that's intriguing.
It's intriguing and promising. I don't think it's quite on the level of tarlatamab, at least for the durability. Remember, ADCs are largely chemo 2.0, and I think there are trials now comparing it to standard second line, until tarlatamab is universally available. Lurbi and topotecan are still the standards there. The field's going to move. We're going to see tarlatamab undoubtedly first-line or maintenance. Where does Lurbi stand in that situation? Does it get demoted again to second-line? And then how does that compare to the ADCs? Will they be equivalent? Will the ADCs be better? How will we sequence them? But for the first time, we're talking about not front or second line. We're talking about third, fourth line regimens for small cell. And the key point that Dr. Shields made and Dr. Gaynor, you don't wait. If these patients start exhibiting progression, you have to work quickly. Progression in small cell is fulminant and relentless and unforgiving.
Yeah, Dr. Shields.
If I may just add on to this excellent point by Dr. Langer. You know, I think, number one, if you look at the Delphi 304, if the sub-arms, Lurbi actually didn't perform that poorly. It actually crossed one if you look at the confidence intervals. So I think it was underpowered there to actually make that comparison. Really, we know it's better than topotecan and amrubicin, which we don't have access to, with it being in Japan for use only. I think with tarlatamab, you know, I have a patient who's been on 15 months and doing phenomenal complete response, but I also have patients that I get the scan at 6 weeks and everything's growing. So it's not a home run for everybody. You have to keep a close eye. You have to, if they have progression in the body, you have to re-image the brain. You have to have a level set to know where the disease is. I think the ADCs are really exciting. They're quick. They respond, you know, high response rates, 50%, 60%. You know, I think with IDXD, we see that dose dependence. We saw at ESMO the intracranial data, you know, presented by Dr. Rocha, And so I think very exciting. I think more to come. How to sequence these is really going to be dependent on biomarkers.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. To the end of tarlatamab and the build-out to get that accessible to patients, you know, the AON network has an all-outpatient bispecific regimen, so they've been able to implement that. Dr. Warsh sort of called that out with when do we start getting ready in that space, and so it's been really successful, little to no CRS or ICANS in that space. I'm going to thank you guys so much for the time today. I really appreciate everything. Your insights were meaningful, I know, to the audience and to me. I learned a lot. So thank you again for your time here today.